Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 2014, about 69,000 children from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala crossed the U.S. border, many of them unaccompanied. Migrants traveling to the United States make the journey in different ways, but face grave dangers and deep trauma. They cling to freight trains known as the Beast. They take buses, vans, or trucks, or they cross the desert on foot. And if they are detained, they might be locked in. It's called Yalira, or the icebox, rooms cooled to a temperature that would preserve meat. In a new book, Solito Solita, meaning Alone Alone, Voice of Witness collected the stories of 15 people who made the harrowing journey to the United States as children. And these young people tell their stories in their own words. Today, we are joined by two of the young people who share their stories in Solito Solita. Gabriel Mendez is a student at UC Berkeley. He is originally from Tegucigalpa, Honduras, and he crossed the border at age 15. Hi, Gabriel. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Soledad Castillo has a degree in liberal studies and criminal justice from San Francisco State University. She is also originally from Tegucigalpa, Honduras, and Soledad crossed the border at age 14. Hi, Soledad. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, good morning.
And we are also joined by the book's co-editors. Jonathan Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and mentor with more than 30 years' experience reporting from Central America, Mexico, and the U.S. border. And Jonathan joins us in studio. Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. We're very grateful to be here.
Thank you so much. We're also joined by Stephen Mayers, writer, oral historian, and professor at City College of San Francisco. Stephen has interviewed Central American migrants for more than a decade. Hi, Stephen. Thank you for coming in.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you, you both, all of you, for coming in. This is a Voice of Witness book, and we've had many of the authors and subjects on the show. And what I love about these books is that they're oral histories. People are able to tell their own stories. Jonathan, can you talk about just how you decided to embark on this important project? And I mean, the timing couldn't be better because of what's happening right now with the border. And just these stories are so, so important to tell.
Thank you, Rose. In 2014, suddenly there were thousands and thousands of unaccompanied minors, young people, children, mothers with kids, teenagers, appearing at the U.S. border. And this was an extraordinary surprise to me. I had covered the border in the early 1980s, advocating for border reforms. And our editorials back then had been partly responsible for Congress passing a law that enabled more than 2.6 million undocumented people to legalize their status. It was called the amnesty. And I had been covering the border for many, many years, but that had been illegal, quote unquote, illegal immigration from Mexico. These young people were coming from Central America. And I think Stephen can talk a little bit about more of the situation then.
Yeah, so I became interested in Central America, studying Latin American literature and history in college over 20 years ago, and lived in Mexico for a while. And I interviewed a lot of refugees from the war years for my dissertation about 10 years ago. And I got involved with Voice of Witness from teaching their books in my class. In my English 1A class at City College, I have my students do oral history projects and have Voice of Witness staff come in and train my students to do oral history projects. So I've been a fan of Voice of Witness for quite a while on the educational side, and had been thinking about proposing a book on this very subject as I was, you know, watching, like Jonathan mentioned, the thousands of children, you know, some of whom are, you know, no older than my 6-year-old son, you know, like clinging on to freight trains and things like this. And so then I met Jonathan at City College, and we really connected not only in the fact that we're interested in immigration, we're interested in humanitarian immigration reform, but we're also very inspired by the narrative and the story and the power of the story to change perceptions. And also Jonathan said something the first time we met about sharing future-oriented narratives, you know, narratives that are driven towards change and the future, which I think we really connected on. And we talked about how young people, children, you know, ideally have most of their lives in front of them, right? These, you know, so they have long futures and a lot, invested in the future, of course. So we put together this book project and have worked hard to try to tell kind of birth to now stories that don't end with the now, but also sort of extend into the future.
And I love what you say in the foreword, quote, "We are much more than refugees, than child migrants, than people who have experienced trauma. While reading these stories, please do not forget that there is also joy," end quote. That really struck me because in the larger media conversation, you just, especially in the soundbite world of media, you just hear the word refugee, child migrant, border, and then, of course, this administration's xenophobic's horrific remarks on a regular basis. And then you might get a soundbite from someone who gave you a little bit of information about why they left. But to read an in-depth piece from their own words is a completely different experience.
Thank you, Rose. We've been working on this for 5 years. We thought the story really started on the U.S. border. But when we began to interview people like our guests today, we asked them, where do you come from? What was your home like? Why did you leave? What was crossing the border like? And what are your struggles today? And most important, what are your goals and dreams for the future? Mm-hmm. And that took us away from the political aspect of this, back into childhoods, growing up in very, very dangerous circumstances in Guatemala, in Honduras, in El Salvador. And those stories are very powerful, and they show something that doesn't come out in the political rhetoric. And that's why we believe this book is a very important, very, very important counter-narrative to the political, so-called political debate.
Now, before we speak with Gabrielle and Soledad, how did you both find these 15 young people? What was that process like?
Yeah, being young, you know, we set out to interview children, and we learned quite quickly, our two biggest considerations were the legal considerations, the fact that, you know, if someone was under 18, we'd need a parent's signature or a guardian signature. And the second big sort of ethical factor is re-traumatization. Mm. You know, the fact that all of our narrators have experienced traumatizing events in their lives, and that telling a story when one is, you know, one is kind of never ready to do it, but yet when one is more prepared to do it in a loving atmosphere can actually be quite therapeutic. And Soledad and Gabrielle both speak to that, although it can also be quite difficult. I mean, it's not just an easy thing to do. So those were our two major considerations. And we, in order to find young people to interview, we started reaching out to organizations, especially legal organizations like Centro Legal de la Raza in Oakland and the East Bay Sanctuary, where we started in Berkeley, and interviewed, sort of gained access to people through lawyers in these organizations who sometimes signed off on them. We interviewed a lot of people who were just over 18 who had crossed maybe when they were 14 or 13, reflecting back. We also interviewed a lot of young mothers who crossed with younger children in order to sort of gain access to those stories from a mother's perspective when we, you know, kind of early on learned that we couldn't really interview 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds or something. Mm. And we also traveled around Mexico to these incredible chain of migrant shelters called Casa Migrantes that form various networks in Mexico and really form a modern underground railroad in many ways, that really the saving grace of people fleeing Central America. You know, this is a place where people can sleep for the night. They can get some clothes, some food, and they can rest assured for a split second that they won't be deported while they're inside. Mm. There's kind of an spoken agreement with the officials that they don't do deportations from inside these. So that's another way we gained access to people throughout Mexico.
Soledad, Before we dive into your story, why did you decide to share it? And what was that process like for you?
It was, at the beginning, it was hard to share my story. But at the end, I find that it was a way for me to healing all the things that I went through when I was a child. And, you know, we always need someone to talk to listen to us, and I didn't have that person. So for me, having Stephen and Jonathan there for me to listen my own story, so it was a privilege. And I know I went through a lot, but reading my own stories will make me more strong.
You have been through so much.
Yes.
And have you read the other stories in the books?
I haven't read all of them, but I have read a few, yes.
Mm-hmm. What was that like for you?
Issues, I mean, we always think that we go through a lot, but when you read other people's stories, issues, I mean, yeah, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's so powerful, you know, because people choose label us as immigrants, that we come here to steal other people's job as a president. That's what he say. And actually, we go through a lot in order for be here. You know, we are resilient. You know, looking at those stories, we all that I can think that we're resilient. You know, and we're hard workers, and all that we wanted was a better life.
Soledad has a degree in liberal studies and criminal justice from San Francisco State University. She crossed the border at age 14, and we'll talk more about her story in a few minutes. But I wanted to ask you the same thing, Gabrielle. Why did you decide to share your story, and what was the process like for you?
I decided to share my story because I thought that it was my duty to educate other members of society who might not gotten through the same struggles that I did. So while I was in high school, I never read a story of like about immigrants. It was always like fiction books. And by sharing my story, I hope many teachers and professors are gonna teach our stories to actually have the other side of the actual history of migration.
And Gabrielle Mendez is a student at UC Berkeley. He crossed the border at age 15. Gabrielle and Soledad are both from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. We're also joined today by Stephen Mayers, a writer, oral historian, and professor at City College of San Francisco, and Jonathan Friedman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and mentor with more than 30 years' experience reporting from Central America, Mexico, and the U.S. border. And we're talking about the new book from Voice of Witness called Solido, Solida. It means alone, alone, crossing borders with youth refugees from Central America. 15 young people tell their own stories in this book. And what I love about the book is all of the young people, there's also a drawing of young people, and they're really beautiful drawings, and about 10 or more pages of their stories. So you really are able to dive in and find out what life was like for them, how they grew up, and their harrowing journey to the United States. This issue is in the news every single day, and on many outlets, it's very simplified. You just hear migrant, child, refugee. But what about the stories of people who are taking this harrowing journey? Can we spend a little bit more time, you know, really talking about the difficulties that people go through? Because what we usually hear is people are escaping poverty and violence. And you might hear about the gangs, about lack of opportunity. But in terms of the detail, that's what's missing. So what would you say really struck both of you when you met with and talked with these young people?
Well, the first time I met Soledad, I was actually leading a writing workshop at City College. And this young woman who I didn't really know much about started crying. And she said she was homeless. She was becoming homeless. So this was Stephen was her teacher at the same time. And so I met this young woman. I didn't really know anything about you. But when we began this project, we discovered that you had fled from Honduras. And I remember sitting in, you had gotten a student housing.
Yes.
We're very proud of it. And there was this blank wall sort of waiting for things to happen. And you were sitting there in your beautiful new apartment. And then you started telling us about what had happened to you as a little girl Would you like to tell our listeners just a little, Soledad, about what you told us happened in your mother's home?
Yes. So my parents got divorced when I was born. So I grew up with my mother and my grandmother. I have four more sisters and one brother. We were the poorest family where we live. So we were really poor. There were days that we didn't have nothing to eat, only tortilla with salt. That was our meal for the whole days, for weeks and months. And my grandmother, she was all already, but she tried to work hard. She had two jobs in order to support us. My mom was a main house housekeeper. She helped other people to wash clothes in order to help us too. And so my parents got divorced, and my mom got together with another guy, my stepfather. And unfortunately, my grandmother passed away when I was 10 years old. In my family, we never showed love to each other. So my mother never told me, oh, daughter, I love you. Oh, so we never have that type of relationship. So my grandmother was the one who always took care of me, who was there for me, who taught me how to be kind and how to love. So when she passed away, it was a big loss for me. I was a little girl, but I still remember all of that. She passed away in my arms. I spent the last day with her. And all that she told me was, take care of yourself. You're going to be good. Mm. And that words still hurts, you know, not having her with me. And after she passed away, a lot of things happened. My grandfather, my stepfather never liked me. So when she passed away, when my grandmother passed away, my stepfather physical abused me. I ran in front of my other two little sisters. And I went to my mom and I told her what happened. And she never believed me. The next day, she packed my clothes and sent me to the city to work with another stranger people. I was only 11 years old, and I had to work to get a food to play, to get food to eat. And I was washing clothes at age 11, taking care of other kids in order for me to survive. And after working in the city for a few months, I got sick. I got misdiagnosed with lupus, so I was at the hospital for 2 years. I was almost dying. So the doctors told my family that I only have 2 weeks left. I was vomiting blood. I lost my hair, my skin. I had all the effects of lupus, and I was in really bad shape. And I got into an accident, and I fell the stairs, and I hurt my leg. And they took me to the private hospital, and they say that I didn't have lupus from nowhere. Like, they say that they mix my file with another patient. So I was in the hospital for 2 years with a disease that I never had. Mm. And so when I got diagnosed with lupus, my mom decided to look for my father. By then, he was here in the United States. And when the doctors told me that I didn't have that disease, I contacted my dad and I asked him, like, please, can you come and bring me with you? I don't want to be here.
You contacted your dad, who was in the United States.
Yeah, my biological dad. And so he was here at the United States, and he agreed to go and see me, and he brought me to the United States. So that was another story, too.
That's just a little bit of Soledad's story, you know, and what I'm struck by so many of these stories is that they, you know, you hear a lot, like Rose was saying, about migrants, about refugees, but of course each person we meet is another human being with a much different story and a lot of details. And so Ladad's story and Gabrielle's story and all the stories in the book go on and on. You know, I mean, you know, the abuse that people suffer in Central America for various reasons is more than I've been through, and most of our readers, I'm sure. Traveling through Mexico is more often than not a second humanitarian crisis. And those who make it here, you know, the lucky ones who make it here, are often brought into yet a third humanitarian crisis where people, for example, who are escaping sexual abuse get sexually abused in our detention centers here.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the sort of three-part epic nature of abuse is astounding. It's one thing
right.
that struck me.
We just did yesterday a show about women who are sexually abused and harassed in detention centers and how the system, for the most part, completely fails them.
That's right.
Yeah. And I decide to speak up because, you know, sexual abuse in our countries, in our community, is not something that we talk about it. And for many years, you know, it was not only one person, but it was different people who physically abused me. And for many years, I thought that it was my fault. Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake that we all women do, you know, like putting the guilt on us when it's not the reality. And it was a hard topic to talk to, but I think I decided to do it because I want other people, other women that went through this day to feel the same way that I did. It's
right.
not your fault. Look for support. Talk about it. I always feel ashamed of myself for sharing this, and it was a really hard topic to talk to other people. But at this point, you know, it's just so common. A lot of people go through that, and it's not... It is not fair for feeling, you know, that guilt that it was our fault when we were so little and we don't have that protection from our parents or from whatever was taking care of us.
So since you don't talk about it, I'm guessing that there's not much help if you need counseling or if you're dealing with trauma yeah. or post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah, so that happened. Sexual abuse happened for 2 years, mm-hmm. like when I was from 11 to 13. And I didn't have any help during those times, so I got help until I came to the United States and I decided to take therapy for 2 years.
And what was that like for you?
It was at the beginning, as I say, it's hard to talk about it. It's hard to disclose yourself to the people that you don't know, to a person that you don't know. But when you start talking, it start, you know, feeling a little bit better. Still painful, you know, the pain... it's not going away. Whatever happened to you is still there, but you get stronger and stronger with the time.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll hear more from Soledad Castillo. She has a degree in liberal studies and criminal justice from San Francisco State. She is originally from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. She crossed the border at age 14, and she tells her story in the new book, Solido Solida, Crossing Borders with Youth Refugees from Central America. We will also hear from Gabriel Mendez. He is a student at UC Berkeley, also from Tegucigalpa, Honduras, and he crossed the border at age 15. Stephen Mayers and Jonathan Friedman are the co-editors of Solida Solida. Stephen is a writer, oral historian, and professor at City College of San Francisco. He has been interviewing Central American migrants for more than a decade. Jonathan Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and mentor with more than 30 years' experience reporting from Central America, Mexico, and the U.S. border. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're talking about young people who leave their homes in Central America and take the harrowing journey to the United States. There's a new book from Voice of Witness called Solido Solida, Crossing Borders with Youth Refugees from Central America. And 15 young people tell their own stories about why they left home. It's very in-depth. And the co-editors are joining us today. Stephen Mayers is a writer, oral historian, and professor at City College of San Francisco. Jonathan Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, and mentor. They both have many, many years' experience interviewing people from Central America. And two of the young people in the book who tell their stories are also here today. Gabriel Mendez is a student at UC Berkeley. He crossed the border at age 15. Soledad Castillo has a degree in liberal studies and criminal justice from San Francisco State. She crossed the border at 14. Soledad and Gabriel are both originally from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Soledad, you were in the middle of telling us your story and talking about how your dad, who was living in the United States at the time when you were in the hospital in Honduras, you actually were told, you overheard that you were going to die.
Yes.
You were misdiagnosed. Thankfully, they learned that you were misdiagnosed, and you're here with us today. But your father did help you from the United States. And then what happened is your father actually came to Honduras, and you saw him for the first time in how many years?
I remember him when I was five. Wow. Four. I barely remember him. Yeah, so it, like more than 8 years that I have when he came back.
What was it like for you to see him again?
I was happy, but at the same time, I was mad at him because he left us. Mm-hmm. And I told him, like, if you would never leave us, maybe I would never, like, went through what I, you know, everything that happened with my stepfather. We suffered so much poverty. Yeah, and I have to see my stepfather hearing, like, physical abuse my mom. So as a little girl, I went through a lot of things that I never wished to see, you know, by that age. And yeah, we talk about it, and I told him, you know, I have my sister. It was hard for me to make the decision because I have my other sisters back then and my brother as well. But I want a new start. I didn't have my mom. My mom was with me at the hospital and everything, but she didn't believe me, and she was still with my stepfather, so I didn't have a place to go.
How old were you when you decided to come to the United States with your father?
I was 14.
14. And do you mind if I ask how old you are now?
I'm 26.
26. So it was a while ago. At that time, at 14, what were you hearing about what it was like for people who left your country to come to the United States?
I always hear amazing things. I mean, I have that little child thinking that my life will change, like, right away, that I'm going to have a better life, that everything will be more easy. It's not like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We always had that prospect in our country, that when people say United States, we always think, like, this amazing. Don't take me wrong. There's more opportunities, but for you to get those opportunities is really hard. You had to struggle a lot, and those are the things that people don't talk over there.
Gabrielle, how old were you when you left?
I was 14, and I was 15 when I was crossing the desert in Texas.
And do you mind if I ask how old you are now?
I'm 20.
20. So that was about
five years ago.
And what about you? What did you hear about from other people who crossed or were thinking about crossing?
I guess, like, all of them were saying that it was hard, but after you cross Rio Grande, there were going to be the opportunities for you. But it was, like, super difficult getting here. And since my mom didn't know how to navigate the system, the educational system, so I had to figure it out, even though I was, like, a new, like, I just had arrived. And it took us a month to know where the district was, to know, like, which school to get enrolled into, and to get the charts, because, like, we don't have, like, records of, like, hospital records and anything here. So we're, like, new people, and we have to go through a lot of medical and other procedures before getting into the educational system and other places.
And before we talk about what happened once you arrived, Gabrielle, would you mind telling us a little bit about what your childhood was like? You also experienced, well, you experienced a lot of violence. Your mom decided to leave the country when you were 7. She left you in a very dangerous living situation. Would you mind talking about that?
Yes. So my mom left because my father was an alcoholic. He would hit her, like, every single day because she would arrive home, like, 2 minutes late. Sometimes it was because of the bus. Sometimes because she had to travel a lot to go to work. So she was going to sell some tamales in the mercados. And she didn't have the time to come early home because, like, she wanted to sell all of her things. And I stayed home with my two siblings. They were younger than me. So there were some other family members in the house who would rape me so many times. So even though I'm like a male, I was sexually abused by other male guys. And I guess like, I don't know like why it happened, but I think I'm not the one who should decide why or like, I don't know. It's just like life. And it was like a lot. And also like I had to live like through a lot since many family members of mine had engaged with criminal acts. And then like many, I was persecuted like when I was in middle school because they wanted to kill me. So I had to go to different towns and escape from violence. And I remember one time when one of the gangsters shot at me. He didn't hit me, but I guess it's super traumatic, like so many experiences. I remember not having food on the table. My mom would have to go sell tamales. And then when she left to the States, she didn't leave any money. My father wouldn't work. He sold all of my mom's belongings. So I had to like go to school and I would sell candies at school to get my sister's food and my grandmother's since she wasn't working and she had breast cancer. So she was going through like her cancer, taking care of kids, and then I was going to school and being raped at the same time for a whole year. But like there were seven different people or more. Ugh.
And Soledad was talking about getting therapy here. What has that been like for you? Just, I mean, sharing your story in the book and then sharing your story right now. Have you been able to get help for that?
Yes, I have gotten into therapy and with a psychiatrist. I have a PTSD and chronic depression because of the things I went through. I guess like the PTSD comes from like a lot of the trauma that I went through, and also because of I saw like while going to school so many bodies of people killed, also people decapitated on the streets. And it was a thing of every day. Like, you will see it in the news, you will see it, like, in the streets, and you will see it even in front of your house.
Mm. And in middle school, you were facing death threats.
Yes.
These stories are so hard to hear. They're so common, too, right? Gabrielle, I mean, do you know of other people going through these things? And, I mean, they're in the book. The stories are in the book.
Yeah, like, so many of my friends in high school, mm-hmm. when we were, like, doing homework or just, like, talking about life, they would tell me that they were raped, too. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know how to, like, tell people about it. They didn't know how to go to therapy. They were ashamed of their story. And, like, they were saying that their father had the fault or their mom. And I was, like, telling them that it's, like, life and the circumstances that we live in Honduras. We couldn't go to the police station just because they were family members of us. They wouldn't trust kids saying that we were raped.
I think this is important to talk about because we've taught a lot of people on the show who've fled. And we've asked them before, is there any help? What you would do here today, right? Living here, you would either, some people would call the police, maybe others wouldn't. You would maybe try to find a social worker or someone to help you with this. But then what we hear is that, just like you said, family members might be in the police or there's a lot of corruption. Mm-hmm. So there's just not much, there's nowhere to turn when you face these traumatic issues.
Yeah, for me, I didn't, my whole family knew, but they decided to ignore it. It's just act like nothing happened. So I didn't have that support in Honduras. It's really common. A lot of girls go through the same. And as a community, I don't think that it's a topic that people talk about it. Mm.
Do you think, what would it take to change that?
Just speak up, you know. I was so scared to speak up and mention these to other people because of the guilt that I felt. Or what would my family members would think if I say this to other people? Just to have the courage to share it, you know, and be strong and believe in yourself that it wasn't your fault.
Jonathan?
I just want to speak as a journalist who traveled through the Central America during the wars. There, the United States was intervening in the destinies of people in those countries. In Guatemala, the United States was arming and training Guatemalan shock troops in massacre to commit massacres and brutal assassinations. In Honduras, where they grew up, the United States had been intervening to arm an army of mercenaries who were fighting against the Nicaraguan Revolution. And in Guatemala, in El Salvador, there was a civil war, and we were intervening on the side of the right-wing military and massacres. Thousands of those kids who'd grown up in those massacres in the 1980s fled to the United States. They landed in cities like Los Angeles, where they were met with really entrenched gangs. And these kids became and formed the worst gangs. So when Gabriel is talking about the murders in the streets, he's talking about things that the United States had intervened, and the results of those things had destabilized the countries of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. So these kids growing up they were suffering things that were enclosed within the family, within the neighborhood, within the community. But Stephen and I have in this book researched and described some of the larger things. People here in the United States say, well, it's very well, you know, I'm so sorry that you suffered these things in your country, but why would you come here? Well, the United States had come there and intervened. Mm. So we do bear, as Stephen said, moral and also legal responsibility for the fates of these kids.
Gabrielle?
So, you asked, if we could report all of these issues, but we couldn't since the police is so corrupt. Mm-hmm. And I will put this into perspective. Before I left in 2013, I remember the Honduran president going into my community and meeting the 18s in my neighborhood and giving them money and giving them, clothes and a new place to play soccer and giving them, so many other opportunities that they weren't given to other individuals. And that money was coming from our same community. So he was doing, corruption before he even became president in front of our eyes.
You know, I think this is really important. What you just said there, people ask, why are they coming here? Well, the United States went there. And, you know, as you write a lot about what happened in El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, the United States deporting gang members back to their war-torn homelands, funded by profits from drug smuggling and extortions, and then the gangs grow into a multinational network. Again, this is the context that is so sorely needed in the stories about immigration. Can you talk about the importance of that? And again, we can talk about this on this show because we have time to go in depth. How do you bring that context into these other news? Let's not even talk about the cable shows, but the 5-minute radio pieces. How do you bring that really important context into those stories?
Yeah, I think, it might be impossible in 5 minutes, but yet, I think, we often, in news pieces, I often hear about stories going back as far as why an individual left. But I think that very rarely do you hear, the U.S. history that Jonathan and you were both referring to as well. And I think it takes a few more pages and a little bit more time to do that, which is why a book-length project like this, I think, is necessary. So time is definitely of essence. And, it just goes to show, thinking about, how deporting gang members sort of out of the country, this kind of out of sight, out of mind mentality, that where we want to get rid of the problem or put a wall up in between us and the problem, it just goes to show that that doesn't make any sense, of course, and the gangs were started here, of course. And we've had a Central American population in this country for decades and decades since the gold rush. I think something like a third of El Salvador's population lives in the U.S. So I think, one thing we're trying to do here is break down this kind of us versus them, this kind of, they are coming over our border. Mm. It's a much more complex history than that,
Right.
And,
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, talking about just the history, U.S. foreign policy, and the United States intervening in so many of these countries. Stephen Mayers and Jonathan Friedman are co-editors of Solido, Solida, Crossing Borders with Youth Refugees from Central America. It means alone, alone. And we're joined by two of the young people who told their stories in the book. Gabriel Mendez is a student at UC Berkeley. He crossed the border at age 15. Soledad Castillo has a degree in liberal studies and criminal justice from San Francisco State. She crossed the border when she was just 14. Soledad is now 26. Gabrielle is 20, and they're both from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Can you talk about the title, Solido, Solida?
Yeah, the title came to us from the second person we interviewed. Actually, no, the first. Soledad was the second person. The first person we interviewed was a guy named Adrian from Guatemala City. And he had witnessed his mother be shot by a gang member when he was 5 years old. His mother ran a small store in Guatemala City, and they were charging renta or rent, you know, they were coming by for their payments. She said she had no money, so they shot his mother in front of his eyes at 5 years old. They later came for him when he was a teenager, and they were trying to get him to join the gang. They shot him and cut him open from, like, his neck all the way down to his waist, left him for dead in the streets, and miraculously some firemen saved him and brought him to a hospital. He escaped and ended up in the detention facilities in Richmond, California, but had no family or money to get out, of course. You know, and the small organization called Civic was that it's a very tiny organization here in the Bay Area that's now called Freedom for Immigrants that organized visitors to go to detention centers just to spend time with people. And this retired ESL professor realized that he needed $2,000 bond, and he needed a family to take him out of the prison. And he organized both of those things and got him out, you know. And if it hadn't been for that tiny organization and that luck, I mean, he would have been, you know, sort of stuck there for forever maybe, you know. He didn't want to get back deported back to his death. So while we were talking to him about riding on La Bestia, the beast, and coming through Mexico, we kept asking him, you know, if he met anyone along the way and if he had friends along the way. And he kept on murmuring, solito, solito, alone, alone. And also he said that in reference to his life here, how alone he felt. And it sort of had a ring to it. And I think the ito, you know, the sort of diminutive Spanish, you know, word seemed to sort of capture the humbleness of his storytelling. Mm. Yeah, so and it was Jonathan's idea to bring the feminine for the second word, solito, solita. Mm-hmm. And like we say in the beginning of the kind of descriptive paragraph of the book, you know, there are thousands of migrants. You know, we hear about the migrants, you know, the group very often, almost every day in the news. But we we've been talking about this entire program, each one of these migrants is a totally separate person. And their experiences migrating here are very isolated and very sort of exiled. Mm. Yeah.
Can you relate to that feeling alone?
Yes.
When you get here?
Definitely. Yeah.
You both have gone through, so much when you were young, and then once you cross crossing the border is a harrowing experience.
Yes.
And then once you get here, you go through so many more things. We have only about 5 minutes left, but I'd love for you both to share, you know, what was it like once you got here?
Yes. So crossing the border took 20 days without food, without water in the desert. So it was a really rough trip, and seeing other people in the desert that didn't make it. So it was really hard to, like, wanting to help, but don't know how. And
you actually saw people who did not make it, right?
Didn't make it, yes. Yeah, and it was, I want to help. And as a little girl, I was like, please come, like, please. Mm. And it was really hard. And coming here, so I have that illusion to go to school. But when we come from Central America, people that come from Central America has that mentality that you only come here to work. So that was the mentality of my dad. So he didn't enroll me to school. And when I got here, I was 14 and working two jobs. I didn't have papers, so I have, you know, to get fake papers. And I was working in two jobs from the morning till night. And yeah, so after a year, he decided to come back to Honduras, and I didn't want to go back with him. So it's when I entered the foster care system. And I have two experiences. I had two foster homes. The first one, she never fit me. So I ended up a lot of times at the hospital. I was
because you were starving.
Starving, yes. And I didn't know anything about the foster care system, so I didn't know how that works, and I didn't speak the language English, so I couldn't communicate with my social worker about what was going on. So I was in that house for 6 months. So I got really sick until another foster youth came to the same house, and she spoke up to the social worker. My second home, they treat me like their daughter, and I still had communication with them. We had a really good relationship. So at age 18, I decided to move to San Francisco. I emancipated from the foster care system and went to City College. I spent 4 years trying to learn English, taking ESL classes. I graduated in 2016 and transferred to San Francisco State, where I graduated last year, too, with honors.
Wow. And now you're advocating.
Yes. Now I work for a nonprofit called Community Work West. I help parents who are in jail that has a CPS case open. Mm-hmm. I help them to have a still communication with their children.
Wow. Gabrielle, we only have a couple of minutes, but can you talk about what your experience was like when you got to the border?
Since my mom was here, I wanted to get her and hug her since I guess it was like 10 years without seeing her. So I wanted to see her because I felt alone in Honduras. I remember being in L.A. and the coyote telling me that if she didn't pay like $50 more on top of the $6,000 she paid, they were going to cut my hair in some like bodegas in L.A., and I was so nervous and telling my mom to please pay those $50. Otherwise, I was going to get killed here in the United States. I wasn't feeling safe. And then, like, I came in December 2013, and I luckily made it. And I guess, like, I had my mom. I still live with my mom since, like, I guess I'm trying to spend more time with her since I didn't have that time in Honduras. And then we brought our two sisters in 2014 too, so they were coming to see us too. Like, we were, like, finally we have like a happy family here in the United States.
And what are you studying at UC Berkeley?
I'm studying social welfare, public policy, and Spanish.
Wow. That's a heavy load.
Yep.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for telling your stories. Do you have any final thoughts just briefly? Just what you want people to know about what young people are going through. As we're seeing right now, a lot more people are coming over the border, and they know what they will face under this mm-hmm. administration. So that really says a lot about what they're facing at home.
I think, yeah. For me, I'm just tired to hear the president telling us that we're criminals.
Mm-hmm.
I've been here for 10 years, and I don't have any criminal records. And just for other people, you know, as Gabriel mentioned, to educate other people about what's going on. Not only we come because of poverty or gang violence, but there's a lot of things too going inside our house over there mm-hmm. that many people don't know. So unless we don't speak up, we never will know, you know.
And just we have a quick email from Kaveh who says, I so admire both of you for overcoming the difficult circumstances of your early years, learning a new language, going to school, and adjusting to life. You're very courageous and generous to share your stories that need to be told. You are valuable additions to this country. I send you love and best wishes for your continued success and healing. That's from one of our listeners.
Thank you.
And Jonathan and Stephen, final thoughts from you?
I just wanted to point out and thank you for putting the link on at the bottom of the program show to our document called 10 Things You Can Do. You know,
yes.
And I think that's a perfect thing to end the program with, in a sense that we in the back of the book and also on a web document that Rose linked to the website for this program are 10 simple sort of things that Americans and Latin Americans can do to help the situation, you know, from volunteering to political action to donating money to, you know, organizations in Central America that are doing good work to fight corruption and crime. And Casa Migrantes, for example, like I was mentioning earlier in the program, as well as legal organizations that are offering pro bono support and help these two courageous individuals, you know, succeed in this country.
So we believe that these stories should be heard. Congresswoman Jackie Spears has promised to tell Gabrielle's story on the floor of the House, and it will be in the congressional record. We believe that they should be called to testify in congressional hearings. And finally, our book is titled Solito Solita, but our the thing we really want to say is from solito to solidarity with refugees from Central America. Mm.
Jonathan Friedman and Stephen Mayers are co-editors of Solito Solita. Stephen is a writer, oral historian, and professor at City College of San Francisco, and Jonathan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for this very important book.
Thank you so much, Rose, for having us.
Very grateful.
Thank you. And we've also been joined by two of the young people who told their stories in this book. Gabriel Mendez is a student at UC Berkeley. He crossed the border when he was just 15. He is now 20, originally from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Gabriel, thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Soledad Castillo has a degree in liberal studies and criminal justice from San Francisco State University. She is now an advocate and an activist. She crossed the border at 14. She is now 26, and she's also from Tegucigalpa, Honduras. Soledad, thank you so much for telling your story, and thanks for all the great work that you do, and thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. And thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Jour Call, we'll discuss the life and history of Harriet Tubman with National Book Award nominee Erica Armstrong Dunbar. She's out with a new book, She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman. Dunbar presents a fresh take on Harriet Tubman, a leading abolitionist who liberated hundreds of slaves. What more can we learn about the life of this country's true icon? Join the next Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.